The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up, the separation of church and state. Bishops defy the government in the House of Lords over a plan to cut benefits.
It's a very simple amendment. It preserves child benefit as a universal benefit.
And it's one of fully six defeats that have been inflicted on Ian Duncan Smith's welfare reform bill in the upper house. Also this week, who fancies Newt?
So I'm happy to be in the tradition of Ronald Reagan as the outsider who scares the Republican establishment. And frankly, after the mess they've made of things, maybe they should be shaken up pretty badly.
As the Republicans move on to Florida, Gingrich storms into contention against the heir presumptive Mitt Romney. And as polling shows the race for the London mayoralty in May is hotting up, could Boris be eyeing a safe seat for a return to Parliament? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian columnist Jackie Ashley, our social affairs editor Randeep Ramesh, and down the line our cherished political sage Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. Well, the ermine-trimmed defeats for the government's plans just keep on coming. The most recent, late on Wednesday, concerned child maintenance. Mutinous nobles, including many a lordly Tory, gave the thumbs down to plans to charge loan parents for getting their child maintenance chased. Of sharper significance to the coalition, however, concerned the Liberal Democrat rebellion earlier in the week on the proposed £26,000 benefit cap. That rebellion was led by none other than Paddy Ashdown. Now, Randeep, why on earth should anyone get more in benefits than the median wage or something like the median wage?
Well, it's all to do with circumstances. If you find yourself in the middle of London and you need your housing paid for, then the council ends up paying for that rent. Now, that rent is often set in the private sector. It's set by the private sector, the market rate. Those market rates are very high. Now, it's not the individual who rents who sets that rent, if you see what I mean. It's the landlord. And so at the heart of this lies this problem of iniquitous rents, and that is to do with housing supply and the lack of it for poor people. That's what doesn't drive down rents.
And so that's very much a London point, Jackie, but the other point the bishops were particularly onto was the sort of size of families here, wasn't it?
Well, exactly. I mean, if you're a single person and you're in work, you presumably need quite a lot less to live on than a married couple with four or five children. And I think this idea of Ian Duncan Smith, he can oversimplify the whole system, it is just ridiculous because he is taking no account of personal circumstances. And I think he sort of got to run away with his rhetoric, thinking we need to have one benefit and one for all. And I just don't think it's going to work in practice.
I suppose as well, he's been the great one for marriage and all of that, hasn't he? And of course, it gives you quite a reward for splitting up in some circumstances. But Mike, Labour are running a mile on this, aren't they? They think public opinion is entirely with the coalition.
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's difficult for everybody, and Duncan Smith isn't a bad man. He's trying his best. He is, as Jackie says, oversimplifying things, but he's also running with the grain of public prejudice. Public prejudice isn't always wrong. Whenever I read these case histories in the newspapers, including mine, I shake my head and so I say, oh, don't do that. No, don't have another one. Please, please. And we all feel that way. I imagine. I don't think I'm particularly unusual. So Ed Miliband has got to try and say, yes, we support a cap. We understand that. But this one isn't going to work. As with the child benefit defeat last night, which all those Tories grandees joined in. I'm sure that made them sleep better, parading their consciences. It was just a silly thing to do. They got a detail wrong. The devil is always in the detail in these things, and the unintended consequences can be horrific.
Fairly damning for the House of Commons, though, isn't it? Like that so much of this stuff just slipped through without anyone noticing at all.
No, that's not fair. No, they won the votes, that's all.
Well, no, but it went through Cabinet Committee. There weren't any reports about arguments on the inside of government about any of this, were there? As there were, you know, as there have been on some other
subjects. Well, I don't assume that all arguments inside government are paraded in public. You've got to pick your fights quite carefully. Interestingly, Nick Clegg is picking one publicly this morning over the tax rates for the poorest. They're lifting the income tax threshold to £10,000 faster than expected. So, you know, this what's the word, dialogue, the choreography of coalition is quite different from what we've had before, and I don't assume a public row doesn't mean there wasn't one.
But I think Tom is right on this point of the Lords actually doing a lot of the detail on a lot of bills going through at the moment. I mean, MPs in the Commons say there's not really very much for them to do at the moment, that a lot of the detailed work is being done in the House of Lords, and that's where you're finding the experts who know their stuff really coming out and explaining what a lot of these clauses and sub-clauses mean. And I think it is very interesting when we think of how the House of Lords is going to be reformed. We're not maybe going to get this kind of very experienced detailed scrutiny in future.
That's why we shouldn't reform it.
Well, I think there's a different thing at play here. I mean, certainly from my perspective, is that what happens in the Lords, as opposed to the MPs, is they are much more susceptible to being influenced by intellectual arguments put forward principally by charities and lobbyists. They take these things seriously, whereas in the Commons, it's the whipping operation seems to be much more preeminent in people's minds about what does this mean for me. And
well, they're on the way up, aren't they? They still want jobs overwhelmingly in the Commons. So
you can have both, I think. You can have an elected kind of second chamber and incorporate this idea that the ideas must win out in the end.
Let's not get carried away here, chaps. I looked up the figures the other day. The rate of defeat in the House of Lords and division under this government is about, I think it's 10 or 15%. I'm talking from memory. When Labour was in office, it was 30-odd percent. And over the last 30 or 40 years, that's roughly the pattern. Labour governments get hammered by all these admirable qualities which you describe, but they're not completely free of a vulgar party calculation. But it is harder to whip the Lords, and they are much more beyond ambition, and on average they know more because they've been around more.
And of course the sad truth is a lot of their wise words and deeds will probably get totally ignored when the Commons overturns all their votes. That's the sad thing about it, isn't it?
I think although Paddy's interdiction gives license to rebel for Lib Dems, especially about the health bill and even on welfare, I think, I mean, having a sort of leader in that form come out against it is quite strong stuff.
Although I did notice that on the detail of the voting, the crossbenchers were much more heavily against the government on this issue of whether people with cancer should continue to get their disability benefits rather than on these much more kind of bottom of the heap issues, if you want to call it that, the kind of unemployed single parents with kids and so on.
Could it be that crossbenchers have more cancer sufferers? It's just a thought.
It could be. They're probably quite a bit older on average. I don't know. We speculate. But they don't have, for example, typically local authority experience of the type that might have made many of the Liberal Democrats who felt uncomfortable about the stuff on the social fund, for example. You know, if you've been a local councillor, maybe you're worried about picking up the pieces in a way that if you're a crossbencher, you've just been out for lunch with Macmillan Cancer Relief or whatever it is and listen to them instead. But looking ahead to the NHS, which is the next big thing, Randeep, and very much in your area, and this one, the government's probably got public opinion against it, hasn't it, rather than on its side. And how do you think that's going to affect what goes on in the Lords?
Very much so. I mean, it's a power play here. We saw the Royal Colleges, the medical establishment, basically meeting over the last couple of days. The Guardian had obtained a draft statement of intent from those colleges, signalling that 19 out of 20 of them did not support the bill. Lansley then launched a guerrilla operation by telephone to reverse that position. He has pulled away some dissenters. He's very much bothered about this stuff because symbolism counts with the NHS. Doctors count, nurses count, because they start telling patients that it's all the fault of the politicians that you're not getting a good service in the health service. So what he must do, but in the parliamentary terms, is to get all those dissenters on board as quickly as possible with a slew of amendments that we're expecting next week to take into account the Lord's principal objections to competition, the private patient cap, and most significantly, the accountability of the Secretary of State to the health service, making him accountable for what goes wrong in it. Now, these are all quite technical matters, but it's the symbolism that counts. Who's against, who's for you? And I think Lansley has done quite well this week, but I dare say next week he's going to encounter bigger problems than he imagines. There are lots of people working against him for good reason, because his bill is a mess, whichever way you look at it.
I mean, Mike, the problem here is that the spending's running out as far as the health service goes, and we're already seeing, Randeep's written about the fact that waiting lists are already going up. And isn't the problem for Lansley that the more arguments there are about this thing and the more time this wretched bill drags on and on, the more he's going to be blamed in the public mind for what happens?
Maybe he's a terrible communicator, Lansley. I had him on the Today programme this week, and, you know, I follow health enough to understand what the poor soul was going on about, but he could have been speaking Mandarin Chinese for most people. and, of course, he's done, as the Select Committee said again this week, chaired by a former Tory Health Secretary, Stephen Dorrell, said, you've got a reform process, an efficiency drive led by the Chief Executive, Sir David Nicholson, going on, and the bill, the reorganisation of primary care is an enormous distraction from it. But I'm much more intrigued by this sort of sacred role of doctors, because, you know, doctors are like journalists. They bury their mistakes. They rarely apologise. And yet the public hates us, quite rightly, or a shower, and loves doctors. And I'm astonished, because one interesting thing Lansley's doing, I mean, I think he's terribly naive about this, he wants to make the doctors take the decisions about where most of the NHS's money is spent. You know, what matters in Rotherham, which may be quite different from what matters in Hastings, and all of it, what our priorities are, what we'll spend the money on. And of course, you know, they'd have to carry the can. No wonder they don't want to do it. They want to be able to blame secretaries of state for what are very often their own mistakes in a literal sense on the operating table, but also the mistakes of priorities and allocation and preventive health care, all the things which we don't do badly in this country. We beat ourselves up, but we could do a lot better.
Okay, back in the Commons this week, the Weekly Centrepiece event, Jackie, went a little bit better for Ed Miliband.
He said that his policies would deliver a steady and sustained economic recovery with falling unemployment. We have a shrinking economy and the highest unemployment in 18 years. Mr. Speaker, how bad do things have to get in our economy to shake him out of his complacency?
As usual, he writes the question before he listens to the answer.
It's pretty impressive to see that Ed can kind of keep his pecker up in these circumstances, isn't it? With the Tories now in most polls, including in the Guardian's own poll, edging back into the lead despite everything that's going on with the economy.
Well, it was a pretty open goal this week, I think, wasn't it? As a lot of people pointed out, if he didn't manage to do well this week when the economy is not doing so well, when can he? But I think he is remarkable in the way that he does not seem to be thrown off balance by the polls, by all the criticism and everything else. He still thinks there's a long game, and whether he's deluding himself about how long he's got, I'm not sure. But he really is not tearing his hair out and sort of weeping every time he opens another poll. And I think, in a way, that's the kind of temperament you need, because it was never going to be easy for whoever had won the Labour leadership during this last year. I think, you know, he's showing the right sort of spirit, but he does need a bit more energy still. That's what's still lacking, I think.
Brandy?
Well, I think he's done pretty well, actually. I come to sort of come round to Ed Miliband more and more, quite the reverse of everybody else, I think.
You could be a trendsetter.
I don't think he's very good on television. I mean, that, everyone knows that, and he doesn't work well on radio. But the actual message and what he's trying to do, which is turn around and refashion a kind of new Labour thinking. I don't mean new Labour, I mean a Labour thinking that one can sell in a few years' time to the
novel
public.
Novel Labour.
He's done a good job. He's really reached out and picked up themes. I mean, the squeezed middle was something Gordon Brown thought about and dropped. He picked it up. No one else did. I mean, it works. You know, being ahead of the game in terms of the idea space is winning him some respect. I just think he needs to sort of translate that into televisual terms.
Mike, I mean, what do you think? I mean, he's ahead in the ideas game, perhaps, but he's down in the polling game.
Well, it's a long game, as it were, opposition politics, and it's awful. Mandelson on the radio this morning, being very sympathetic, said, you know, he's in an unenviable place, to which I shouted at the radio, like you do, don't you? Well, he didn't have to be there, you know. He could have let his big brother take the shine off the ball. I realise I'm mixing my metaphors, sorry. You know, he could have let leader of the opposition, after a serious defeat as Labour suffered in 2010, you're most unlikely to reach the promised land. I mean, maybe the coalition will get it all wrong, but as our poll and everybody else says, not doing so at the moment, they're getting the benefit of the doubt. I wouldn't disagree with what the colleagues say, but Ed doesn't have command of sort of demotic language of the street, language that connects with ordinary people. He shouts too much in question time, and I think he should perhaps make more jokes, you know, and laugh at him. We know that David Cameron's quite thin-skinned, and it brings out the unattractive flashman side of his personality. We saw it a bit yesterday, so when he's rattled a bit, he gets quick to resort to abuse. So, yes, I think he's doing better than it's fashionable to say so, but it is tough, and he hasn't made a breakthrough, and he's got a lot of things against him. He's got to reinvent himself and talk in a way that doesn't make him sound like a policy wonk who went straight from school to Whitehall, and it's quite a big ask.
Quite a big ask indeed. Well, let's leave Britain there just for a moment and zoom across the Atlantic to where a week ago bookmakers were paying out to anyone who had backed Mitt Romney to be the Republicans' nominee in the November US election. But then this happened.
Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich has defeated Mitt Romney to win South Carolina's Republican primary.
It wasn't a defeat in South Carolina, it was a whitewash. Gingrich had been polling neck and neck the previous week, who went on to win by 12 percentage points to throw open the race for the right to take on Barack Obama for the presidency. Well, earlier I spoke to our Washington correspondent Richard Adams. I put to him what once looked like a simple win for Mitt Romney does not look so any longer.
It's not quite so simple at all, and that's all down to the result in South Carolina, where Newt Gingrich, who was trailing Mitt Romney in the polls by quite a way, suddenly stormed back with a couple of debate performances, just swept in and took South Carolina, and then that really changed everything. And as a result, Newt Gingrich is now climbing in the national polls as well, and Romney's having to fight back, so it's quite a nasty fight.
But I mean, he remains, doesn't he, Newt Gingrich, a very controversial, maybe even a uniquely controversial figure.
Well, it's strange, really, because you know his heyday, of course, was in the 1990s. In 1994, he led the Republicans to a pretty massive victory in the midterm elections there, with the
contract Speaker of the House.
He was Speaker of the House and was very much the mastermind behind it as well. And then he got into an enormous battle with the Clinton administration, which led to the government being shut down. But he ended up losing that, and Clinton came out of it better than ever. And about 2 years later, he was himself dumped by the Republicans. And so it's weird, but of course, the very strange thing about this is Gingrich's heyday was, well, we're now talking about the mid-90s. I mean, this would be like John Major making a comeback and running to be leader of the Conservative Party. That's how long ago we're talking about.
Gingrich, as you've been saying, is a very partisan figure, a guy who wanted to go to the brink with Clinton. Obama, by contrast, made this great play about bipartisanship reaching out across the aisle when he first came into the White House, and to the dismay of many liberals even after he got there. But in his State of the Union, some watchers have been observing a bit more fight and a bit less pretense of being all things to all men.
At stake right now is not who wins the next election. After all, we just had an election. At stake is whether new jobs and industries take root in this country or somewhere else.
It's partly a function of the fact that there's a presidential election later this year. So a State of the Union address in a presidential election year is always going to be a bit more openly partisan. But, Obama had a very interesting tactic last night, I thought, which was he's been opposed. You're right, he came in with a rhetoric of bipartisanship, although that's not unusual in American presidents. And he was faced with an unusual degree of intransigence from Republicans. I mean, they had an opportunity to embrace him, but they took the opposite direction and just flat out opposed everything. And that's been their tactic ever since. And it's made life very difficult for him. Now, what Obama did last night was a number of occasions he referred to different topics, including immigration and tax reform and budget deficit and a few other things. And he would say, well, I know in the current political climate we can't actually expect any major reforms on this subject, but why don't we do this smaller thing? And it's very interesting because he's sort of, on the one hand, acknowledging that there is a big gap between the two parties, but he's also trying to get across to the public that he can get things done and attempt to paint the Republicans as the unreasonable ones. So I thought that was very clever piece of work.
Now, Michael White, Richard Adams there, but you've also spent time out in Washington. It's an eccentric process, as far as we're concerned, over here, isn't it, the way they vet their candidates. Do you think in the end it works? Do you think in the end they toughen people up compared to how Ed Miliband comes across, for example?
Well, you could say we're heading their way. We've dabbled with primary processes. The Tories last time even dabbled with open primary schools, which got that woman, Sarah Wollaston, elected for somewhere in South Devon, one of Andrew Lansley's fiercest critics in the party. She's a GP. She doesn't feel loyal to the party. And, of course, party structures are very weak in the United States. I think it's a pretty rough process, and the quality of candidates they attract for such a vast and talented land is, you know, pretty depressing. And I'm afraid that's turned out to be the case with President Obama, who is very much a B-list president so far. He's certainly lucky in his opponents. So I don't like it. I particularly don't like the way money, the Supreme Court ruling of a couple of years ago, which allowed the emergence of these super PACs, where you don't have to say where the money's coming from at the time. You pile the money in, you're semi-connected with the candidate, and both Romney and Gingrich have been doing the most terrible things, or their supporters have. Television adverts, one of the things the Europeans get right, banning paid political TV advertising, so important to the public space. We've not gone down that road. That's the corrupting process for both the dialogue. It's a bit like running a presidential campaign on Twitter, 15-second TV spots. It's brutal and stupid.
But Jackie, I mean, if you were Barack Obama right now, you'd be fairly chipper, wouldn't you, to just watch these opponents knocking the hell out of each other and ignoring you?
Well, I think you would. I think you'd have been thinking up until recently that Romney was going to walk it and you'd be planning your campaign against him. But now, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if Gingrich doesn't storm through. One interesting little fact I saw is that South Carolina, where he had his great victory, 30% of voters think that Obama is a Muslim. So that says something about how he got his
victory.
He's
a gay Muslim. He's a gay African Muslim.
But there we go. Who knows? I think he has got that air of someone that could well end up as the candidate, in which case I think that's all to the good for Obama. I think he'll find Gingrich an easier opponent than Romney would have been. And I think Obama, I disagree with Mike. I think he's been disappointing, but I don't think he's that disappointing, and certainly the best of a fairly bad field for 2012. And I think he is starting to sharpen up his rhetoric. I thought the State of the Union speech was quite good, showing that he's coming out fighting a little bit more. So you never know. A second term, he may delight us all.
But it does depend a bit, doesn't it, Randeep, on whether the old line about people vote with their pocketbooks in the end is right or not with Obama?
Well, Obama had an advantage because he's seen output in the American economy return to its pre-recession levels in 2007. So he could quite rightly correct in saying America is back in his State of Union address. I think the problem for him is stealing the sort of hope agenda, because what he's come out with is an equality agenda. That's good in a way that he talks about redistribution being part of the American dream too, and the middle classes reclaiming their slice of the pie. The problem for him is, as we've seen this morning, Newt Gingrich comes out with an idea saying, I'm going to have a lunar colony on the moon. Now, this is very much the sunshine America. We're back. You know, we're going to take back our preeminent position in the world. Obama knows this, because if you read Ryan Lizer's piece in The New Yorker, he specifically asked when he arrived in the White House for a big project. What could I sell as the Obama sort of white elephant, if you like, the great thing, that the great hope for America? And they said, there's no money. You can't do any of it.
Gingrich, it's not sunshine, it's moonshine.
I agree with you. I'm not suggesting it's the political impetus for reaching such a symbol.
He's not going to make it. These candidates, you know, these Republicans we've seen, most of the wackier ones,
you know,
have
they're all the
out.
Same. Pitchfork Rebellion. I know what you're saying, but it's, you do need a bit of hope in America to win elections.
Absolutely, you need hope here too. That's where Cameron, incidentally, scores quite well. He always sounds cheerful, even as things get worse. Gingrich is a bad man. I don't think the others are bad men, but he's got a track record both in his private life and his political life as a petulant, erratic, bad-tempered, greedy, very clever, incidentally, a man who's written more books than Ronald Reagan. But Ronald Reagan wasn't a bad person. And
I'm not sure that Mitt Romney's tax bill makes him a particularly good man, does it?
Well, it just means he, you know, Americans don't believe in paying tax. They didn't believe that's what the Boston Tea Party was about. It's what the Tea Party is about today. It's about rich people organizing poor people to riot so so that the rich people don't have to pay their taxes to the government.
I'm going to wildly change course now by just saying, if this is the year of the newt, Jackie, we can't leave it without having a quick word about Ken Livingstone, who in the last fortnight has been two polls.
Fantastic segment.
You've been working on that for the last 10 minutes.
This is all going to go, you know.
Taking Mike's clip for tip for Ed Miliband, I just sort of throw in a few gags and we'll keep the audience numbers up. Jackie, two polls. It was said a very short time ago that Boris Johnson was going to walk it. Two polls now saying it's on a knife edge, maybe even
interesting. Interesting. I think it's not insignificant that it's come just as all the fare rises have been coming through. And I think Londoners have been very cross by the fare rises and are blaming Boris. Whether by the time we then get to the mayoral election, they've got other things on their mind. You see, we'll have the Olympics and Boris all over the place, opening the Olympics and everything. I still probably would put my money on Boris, actually.
Any thoughts, Randy?
I think Ken's playing a clever game. I think Boris will probably still squeak it at the moment. Ken's still a bit of a retread candidate, although he may pull something off when it comes to housing or another key issue. And he's done well in the outer suburbs, which is where he lost it last time. So he's campaigning pretty hard in those places.
And Mike, I mean, it's a huge one domestically, this, isn't it? Because so far, Ed Miliband's been... in Westminster terms, it's a huge thing. Because so far, Ed Miliband's been able to say, oh, well, you know, I might have bad poll ratings, but every time there's a real vote in a by-election or whatever, I've done okay. If Ken Livingstone's back in City Hall, Ed Miliband looks very secure suddenly.
Yeah, I felt, as Randy said, that Ken was the wrong candidate, and it's an indictment of all sorts of things, including the willingness of volunteers to come into public life and be abused by the press, that they had to pick Ken Livingstone, who's even older than I am, only by about 3 months, and he's got more energy than me, but nonetheless wrong candidate. I suspect Boris will fake his way back. So Jackie mentioned big ideas a minute ago. Well, Boris Island, although, again, moonshine may not be. But I just sort of have a final thought. Who do you think David Cameron will vote for?
That's it. Because we had this story this week that if Boris loses... maybe there are a few people angling him up for a safe seat in Surrey. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Thanks to everyone, to Mike White, to Jackie Ashley and to Randeep Ramesh. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.